2 Samuel 7:8 and following verses, A Kingship Forever, the 16th talk in a series titled The Bible's Greatest Hits, was presented by David Crabtree on February 10, 1998, at an evening class of McKinsey Study Center and Institute of Gutenberg College. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2012. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved. The following recording has a brief break in the middle and the loss of some teaching at the end. These are the result of the original tape switching to the second side and running out before the end of the teaching.
Over the last few weeks, we're going through the great covenants, the Abrahamic covenant and the Mosaic covenant, and tonight we're going to do the Davidic covenant in 2 Samuel chapter 7. I signed up for doing this lecture before I had studied the passage, which means that it's one of those adventures. And I had a great time looking at the passage and sorting it out. There are a lot of problems, and I made some progress towards solving them. But it's not going to be a neat package all tied up with all the loose ends dealt with. And I think that what you need to expect whenever I teach is that all the loose ends will not be tied up, which means that you have to do the work of sorting out and making your own decision as to exactly how to piece this all together. So what I would like to do tonight is go through this passage and lay out the various problems for you and my thinking on it, and then afterwards we can all work together at tying up the loose ends. The context of this passage, 2 Samuel, I never know how much detail to go into in talking about the background, but in studying the Old Testament, the background is absolutely crucial. If you don't understand the flow of history, you really can't understand how this thing fits in, and how its relevance and significance and exactly what's going on. So, at the risk of boring you, I'd like to go back and talk about the flow of history and how we get to the point of God addressing King David. Last week when I talked about the Mosaic Covenant, we were in the Sinai, so I guess I'll pick up in the Sinai Desert. After having received the law from God at Mount Sinai, the Israelites moved out from there and were led by God to Palestine, to the southern approach to Palestine. God said, go in and take the land, possess it. And they sent spies in to look and see how difficult a task that was going to be. The spies came back, and most of the spies, all but two of the spies, came back and said, I don't think so. We can't do that. And so the people of Israel refused to go in. God chastised them for their lack of faith. And so the Israelites then said, yes, we are going in. And God said, then I'm not going with you. And they went in. They were defeated soundly, routed, and had to flee from the land. So God put them... led them back into the wilderness for 40 years, and then finally, after 40 years, he brought them back to the east door of Palestine and led them in, and they conquered the land. They conquered the land over quite a number of years. It was not easy. But they did, over a protracted period of time, for the most part, secure the land. During that time, while they were trying to secure the land, they were ruled by judges. And the judges seem to have been people that God would raise up, that these people would come along, they would address the people and were able to gain a hearing from a segment of the population and lead them against one of the surrounding peoples that were oppressing the Israelites at that time. So God would raise up this one individual to provide leadership, and that person would provide that leadership for a period of time. And when another judge was needed, God would raise up another judge. Now, there is some indication that once God had raised a person up as a judge, that the sons of that judge would have a certain amount of power and influence. Gideon, for instance, his sons then went on to have a certain amount of power and influence. As we get towards the end of the period of the judges, we have judges who are priests. Eli, for instance, was a judge, and he came from a priestly family. He had been a priest, and he judged Israel he served as judge. A judge is not the best term. They did apparently, these judges that God raised up did apparently function as judges. They did a certain amount of judicial kind of problem solving, conflict resolution tasks, as well as providing political and military leadership. But what they're usually recognized for is providing that kind of leadership against oppressors. So I'm not sure that judge is the best term for it, but that's the term that's used here, and that's what we'll go with. Eli was a judge for 40 years, but his sons were absolutely rotten. God raised up another individual, Samuel, as a at birth he was set aside for a special task and was raised by Eli in the temple. And when Eli died, then Samuel became a judge. Samuel served as a judge for a number of years. He had two sons, and his sons also were rotten. So the people of Israel were looking at this trend. We've got God seems to be settling in on these priests, and in a sense this line of priests to be the judges of Israel. And what we see coming up, and he seems to be going priest to son, or at least adopted son, and it looks like it's going to be son of Samuel then that will be our next judge, and he's a jerk. So all of a sudden the Israelites start thinking, maybe we need a different kind of leadership. Maybe we need leadership on a different basis. And they say, we want a king. They go to Samuel and they say, appoint us a king. Samuel says, no. Samuel says that would be a mistake. But he takes the request to God, and God says, well, it will be a mistake. And tell them it will be a mistake. But let them have a king. An interesting feature of that particular moment is that in Deuteronomy, while the Israelites were still in the desert just before they entered into Palestine, God had a lot to say to them. One of the things that he said was, when you get in the land, you will ask for a king, and a king will be granted you, and he will oppress you. So here in Samuel, in 1 Samuel 7, then, when the Israelites ask for a king, God grants that, and Samuel is sent out to anoint the first king of Israel, according to the request of the people. Samuel goes out to find this king. Let's see, how's this work? I don't think he drew lots this time. I think God just directed him to the family. And then, Samuel came to, or Saul ends up kind of by a long story I won't get into, but Saul ends up coming to Samuel, and God tells Samuel, that's the one. And Samuel anoints Saul. And the things that it says, the characteristics that it picks out that make Saul the outstanding candidate, three words. He was choice, he was tall, and he was handsome. Choice, tall, and handsome. No, tall, choice, and handsome. He looked like a great king. He looked like he had all of the necessary attributes for a king. And so he was the one that God had Samuel anoint. What is interesting as you go through and read the story of Saul is that he turns out to be, right from the beginning, very insecure in his position. He is very fearful of losing the crown, losing his power. And as a result, when it comes to a choice between following God's instructions and giving in to what the people want, he consistently errs in the latter of giving in to what the people want. So it turns out that he looked the part of a king, but he lacks the strength of character to really serve as a leader. There are several times that Saul disobeyed God, and as a result, God finally announced that he would take the crown from him and his family. And God sent a spirit, an evil spirit, to descend on Saul, and Saul exhibits a certain amount of insanity, and which seems to increase as time goes on. Meanwhile, God sent Samuel out to anoint someone who was going to take Saul's place, who would become the next king. And this time, God sent Samuel to the family of Jesse. He had to go clandestinely because if Saul found out where Samuel was going and why, Samuel probably would have been put to death. So he went clandestinely. He went to the family of Jesse. And Samuel said, let me see your sons. And the first son comes in and Samuel says, that's him. He's tall, choice, and handsome. And God says, wrong. Let me read that. 1 Samuel 16:7. Then it came about when they entered that he, that is Samuel, looked at Eliab and thought, surely the Lord's anointed is before him, before God. But the Lord said to Samuel, do not look at his appearance or at the height of his stature, because I have rejected him. For God sees not as a man sees. For man looks at the outward appearance, but the Lord looks at the heart. So in the selection of Saul, God gave them what they wanted. He gave them someone that looked like a king, who looked the part. But his character was not that of a king, not that of a good leader. On the second go-around, having rejected that king proved himself to be a loser. On the second go-around, God tells Samuel, I don't look at a person's appearance. I judge on a different basis. I look at their heart. And that person is not the man. So then all the other brothers come in, and God tells Samuel, no, not that one, not that one, not that one. And he gets to the end of all the brothers. And Samuel says, well, are there any other brothers? And Jesse says, well, yeah, there's the youngest. He's out taking care of the sheep. And Samuel says, well, go get him and bring him. And they bring him in. And God tells Samuel, that's the one. And David was that one. So David was anointed. And over a period of time, David became a very brave and charismatic leader of the military. In fact, he was very successful in leading Israel's troops against the Philistines, so successful that his popularity surpassed that of Saul's. And Saul became very jealous of that. David, as a reward for his bravery and the victories that he was able to achieve over the Philistines, was allowed to marry the daughter of Saul. But that only seemed to increase Saul's jealousy. And so Saul then became bent on killing David. He was so jealous. David, as a result, was forced to flee. Saul pursued him over an extended period of time. David, with a small number of soldiers loyal to him, evaded Saul. On a number of occasions, David could easily have killed Saul. But on each occasion, David said, "I cannot kill him. I can't take his life because he is God's anointed." He had great respect for that position and refused to take Saul's life as a result. Eventually, Saul was killed in a conflict, in a battle with the Philistines. And David, over a period of time, became king. He became first king just of the tribe of Judah, which is the tribe that he was from. And then it was a little while yet before he was able to gain the loyalty of the rest of Israel. But eventually, though, he was proclaimed king of both Judah and Israel. As king, David was very successful militarily. He led the Israelites against the Philistines and pushed them back. Expanded the territory on which the Israelites were able to control the land and live there. He also gained control of Jerusalem, which then became the capital of Israel. And he took the Ark of the Covenant, which had been in storage. The Ark of the Covenant, if you will recall, was a box that God had the Israelites build when they were in the wilderness. And into this Ark of Covenant were put some of the most holy objects that the Israelites had. The only one at this time that was still there was the tablets that were given, that were written by God and given to Moses. They were kept in the Ark of the Covenant. This Ark of the Covenant was the seat on which God resided. And no one was to touch it. And only Levitical priests could even carry it. And the way they carried it was by carrying it. It had poles that went through these rings on the side of the box. And they had to carry it by these poles without touching it. David decided that he was going to bring that ark out of storage to Jerusalem, which had become the new capital. He wanted the seed of God to be moved to Jerusalem. Then as things settled down, he had a palace built for himself in Jerusalem using cedar provided by his ally Hiram, of the king of Tyre. And he enjoyed at that time then peace from the conflict with the surrounding peoples. And that is the situation then that we, as things stand, when we look at 2 Samuel 7, right at the beginning of the chapter. In the first seven verses, it gives the account of a proposal that David makes. I'll read those first seven verses. "Now it came about when the king lived in his house, and the Lord had given him rest on every side from all his enemies, that the king said to Nathan the prophet, 'See, now I dwell in a house of cedar, But the ark of God dwells within tent curtains. And Nathan said to the king, Go, do all that is in your mind, for the Lord is with you. But it came about in the same night that the word of the Lord came to Nathan, saying, Go and say to my servant David, Thus says the Lord, Are you the one who should build me a house to dwell in? For I have not dwelt in a house since the day I brought up the sons of Israel from Egypt, even to this day. But I have been moving about in a tent, even in a tabernacle. Wherever I have gone with all the sons of Israel, did I speak a word with one of the tribes of Israel, which I have commanded to shepherd my people Israel, saying, Why have you not built me a house of cedar? So apparently, after having built his palace, David felt a bit guilty that he had expended all this money and this time on building for himself a place to live, and yet God didn't have a permanent dwelling, didn't have, presumably what he has in mind is a temple, a permanent building to replace the tabernacle, this tent, that they had built in the wilderness and carried with them all that time, and that was the tent in which the Ark of the Covenant was placed. So David wants to build a more permanent place for God in Jerusalem, building it of cedar, a very valuable material at that time, something that would presumably match or outdo his own house. And Nathan, who was a prophet, and Nathan is a prophet throughout David's lifetime, David consulted with Nathan, and Nathan said, go ahead and do it. You have God's, God is on your side. God is approving of you. Go ahead and do what has occurred to you. But during the night, God spoke to Nathan and overruled that first opinion that Nathan had given. And God's response is, in verse 5, Thus says the Lord, Are you the one who should build me a house to dwell in? In other words, he's saying, Will you build a house for me? Are you the one that will build a house for me? That's the question that he's raising. Are you the appropriate one to build a house for me, God? And then he goes on to say a curious thing. For I have not dwelt in a house since the day I brought up the sons of Israel from Egypt, even to this day, but I have been moving about in a tent, even a tabernacle. Wherever I have gone with all the sons of Israel, did I speak a word with one, that means one person, of the tribes of Israel, which I commanded to shepherd my people Israel, saying, Why have you not built me a house of cedar? Now, the only sense I can make of this, I mean, there are two ways that one could take this. One is, he could be saying, I've been moving around in a tent for a long time, and not yet have I asked for any of the leaders of Israel to build me a house. The implication could be, it's high time someone do it. Now it's been a long time. I really do. That really is the next thing that should happen. The other possibility is that he could be saying, "I've been living in a tent for a long time, and there have been a lot of leaders of Israel that I have raised up, but I haven't asked any of them to build me a house of cedar." The other implication could be, I don't want a house of cedar. If I had wanted it, I would have asked someone. In any case, this is a curious reason that he's giving for why David ought not to build him a house out of cedar. Then God goes on to tell say what Nathan should pass on to David. Verse 8. Now therefore, thus you shall say to my servant David, thus says the Lord of hosts, I took you from the pasture, from following the sheep, that you should be ruler over my people Israel. And I have been with you wherever you have gone, and have cut off all your enemies from before you, and I will make you a great name, like the name of the great men who are on the earth. I will also appoint a place for my people Israel, and will plant them, that they may live in their own place and not be disturbed again. Nor will the wicked afflict them any more as formerly. Even from the day that I commanded judges to be over my people Israel, and I, even from the day that that I commanded judges to be over my people Israel, and I will give you rest from all your enemies. The Lord also declares to you that the Lord will make a house for you. So in essence, what he's saying here is, I brought you up from a nobody. I made you king out of nowhere. I have granted you success. And what I'm going to do in the future is, I am going to make your name great. Even in worldly terms, your name is going to be great. Even as in history as it's written here, your name will be great. I will give Israel a secure and safe and peaceful place. And I will make a house for you. You aren't going to make a house for me. I am going to make a house for you. Now, something to note here is, when David said he wanted to make a house, he qualifies it by saying a house of cedar. So by the word house, what David means is a building, presumably a temple. God's response is, you aren't going to make a house for me, I'm going to make a house for you. He uses the same word, but he doesn't have in mind a building. House in Hebrew has some of the same flexibility, same breadth of meaning that our word house has. And I think what he means here, we'll get to it. I'm not sure what he means here. I'll save it. But keep that in mind. It apparently is not the same kind of house that David was suggesting that he build for God. It's a different kind of house. Now we get to the sticky part. Verses 12 through 17. And here's what God goes on. He has more to say to David. And God is going to promise that he will raise up from David a seed. And then it goes on to talk about that seed, and it uses just the pronoun. And the pronoun that follows in Hebrew would be the same, whether it's translating seed as it or translating it as he. So the translator in your Bible has chosen between those two options. It could be it or it could be he in the Hebrew. But he is the one that has been selected, at least by my translator. So the question is, who is he referring to? Who is the seed and all the things that are said about him or it? One option is it could be talking about Solomon. But when we read through this stuff, you can think, who he has in mind here is Solomon. That's the seed. Another option is not Solomon, but a whole dynasty. By seed, he could mean not one person, but a whole line. The offspring, the whole line of kings that would follow after David. Another possibility is that what he has in mind is Jesus. The seed is Jesus. And all the claims that he had, that he's making here refer to Jesus. The fourth option is that it's a mixture. That some of what he says refers to Solomon, some of what he refers he says refers to Jesus. Some of what he refers to the whole dynasty, that it jumps back and forth, that it's a mixture. Now, I have a bias here, and I want to tell you what that is. I don't like this option right from the very beginning. Because as we read through, it is not clear that some of it refers to one person and other parts of it refer to another person. If I were to write a story about Fred McGillicuddy, and for the rest of the story I always use he, you're going to assume that those he's all refer to Fred. If it refers to Peter McDougall, I need to give you some tip-off that that's the case. Some indication that I have a different antecedent for that pronoun. I don't see an indication here that we're switching antecedents to the pronoun. So I am very reluctant to go this way. Now, it's argued that in prophecy that this is common to have this kind of mixture. Could be. But that's going to be my last choice. I'm only going to go there if I have to. That's my presupposition going in. Okay, let's look at it and see if we can sort it out. Verse 12. When your days are complete, he's talking to David. When your days are complete and you lie down with your fathers, I will raise up your descendant after you, who will come forth from you, and I will establish his kingdom. He shall build a house for my name, and I will establish the throne of his kingdom forever. I will be a father to him, and he will be a son to me. When he commits iniquity, I will correct him with the rod of men and the strokes of the sons of men. But my loving kindness shall not depart from him, as I took it away from Saul, whom I removed from before you. And your house and your kingdom shall endure forever. Shall endure before me forever. Your throne shall be established forever. In accordance with all these words and all this vision, so Nathan spoke to David. Now let's just go through piece by piece and see if we can dissect it. Let me start by looking at the word descendant. The word there is literally the word seed. I'm convinced that the word seed, at least as it's used in Genesis, in all but one instance where it's talking about people, has a very important connotation. That seed does not mean just offspring, but it means the line of promise, the line through which God's promises will be inherited. It is interesting. I won't go through all of the passages in Genesis where seed is used. I just want to look at two or three of them. In Genesis 4:25, after Abel was killed by Cain, Adam and Eve had another child, Seth. They named him Seth because he was appointed to take the place of Cain. Here it announces the birth of Seth in 4:25. And Adam had relations with his wife again, and she gave birth to a son and named him Seth. For she said, God has appointed me another seed in the place of Abel, for Cain killed him. Then remember a few weeks back when I talked about this passage, I made mention of verse 3 of chapter 5, where it says, when Adam had lived 130 years, he became the father of a son in his own likeness, according to his image, and named him Seth. And the significance of that passage, when I talked about it a few weeks ago, is his own likeness is in his own image, is the same wording that is used with reference to Adam when God made Adam. God made Adam in his own image, according to his own likeness. And what I argued is that in the context, the thing that makes the most sense is that here, Seth resembled Adam in his moral character. In the context, that's what makes the most sense. It's not his red hair, but rather it's his moral character that is like Adam's, as opposed to Cain. Well, it is also said of Seth that he is the offspring of Adam. I'm sorry, I don't want to use offspring, I want to use seed. He is the seed of Adam. He's not just the offspring, he's just not a kid of Adam, but he's the seed. He's the one who will inherit. He's the one that's going to be designated by Adam to be the inheritor of the promises. It never refers to Cain as the seed of Adam. In fact, we don't use seed being used with respect to any offspring that do not inherit, except one. There's one exception to that. And that passage is really important. Let's look at that. Genesis 21:12. If you will recall, Abraham was promised a son, an heir. But Abraham and Sarah were getting pretty old, and it wasn't looking too good. It wasn't looking like they were going to have a child. So they began to think about that prophecy that God had made, that they would have a child, and decided that what they needed to do was get that child differently. And so Abraham slept with Hagar, Sarah's maidservant, and had a child by her. And that child was Ishmael. But after Ishmael was born, God came to them and said, no, that's not what I meant. What I meant is you're going to have a child through Sarah. And so Sarah became pregnant then when Ishmael was about 12-ish. And Isaac was born. So then there was friction between the two mothers and the two children. And in the midst of that friction, here's what God says to Abraham. Verse 12. But God said to Abraham, do not be distressed because of the lad and your maid. Whatever Sarah tells you, listen to her. For through Isaac, your descendants, your seed, shall be named. And of the son of the maid, I will make a nation also, because he is your descendant. Here, both times, seed is the word that is used. But he's making this distinction between the kind of seed that Isaac is and the kind of seed that Ishmael is. Isaac is going to be the seed through whom his descendants shall be named. That will be the line of promise. That will be the line of inheritance. That's the line that inherits that promise that God gave to Abraham. Ishmael would become a great nation also because he is also Abraham's seed. Now, I think what's happening here is the author is setting up, he's explaining what he means by seed by using it in two different senses. That the first time he means seed in the sense of that line which will inherit the promises. In the second one, he means the seed in the sense of offspring. So, I think what he would do if he were to punctuate it would be to capitalize it in the first instance and have it small in the second instance. And that every place else that it occurs with respect to people in Genesis, it is meant to be in this sense. Not just offspring, but the line of inheritance. And that becomes really significant, I think, in understanding Genesis chapter 3 in the curses that God proclaims when he proclaims the curses on the woman In Genesis 3, verse 15, he says, I will put enmity between you and the woman, and between your seed and her seed. If seed indicates the line of inheritance, how does the father decide who will inherit? Well, traditionally, it was the oldest child, the oldest male. But as you go through Genesis, not only is that rule not kept, what you see in Genesis is consistently, it is not the oldest that inherits. And the person who inherits is picked on a different basis, and that is on the basis of who it is, which of the children is the father attracted to, which of the children is what the father would like his children to be like, most characterizes what he would like in his children. So with inheritance, the idea of inheritance comes the child that has the kind of character that I want to perpetuate, that I want to go on. So I think what it has in this curse is it's talking about between your seed, that is the woman's, let's see, between your seed. I'll put enmity between, oh, this is, I'm sorry, this is the curse to the snake. I'll put enmity between you, the serpent, and the woman, and between your seed, that is the serpent's seed. So I would take that to mean those who are, reflect the character that was manifest by the serpent in the garden, and her seed, the line of promise, are the ones that reflect her character. Okay. In any case, what I'm suggesting is that the word seed is a really significant word, at least in Genesis. It does not just mean offspring, but rather it's reserved for that line of descent through which the promises are inherited. And I suspect that we have a similar thing happening here in Samuel. 2 Samuel 7, that it is used in this loaded sense.
An author coining a word and using it the way he wants. Not claiming that Moses wrote 2 Samuel.
No.
So how is it God who's using the seed? Is he the author who's using the seed? I mean, how are you putting that together?
Well, I'm not... I don't know who wrote Samuel. It has his name on it, so let's just say Samuel wrote it. But Samuel knew Genesis. I'm assuming that Samuel knew Genesis. Samuel is very familiar with the Pentateuch and understands the significance that's been attached to it. Furthermore, this is what God said, and God knows the Pentateuch. So it's a meaning that's been attached to this word. A significance has been given to this word over a tradition, and that same connotation is being called upon here as well by the use of that word. Okay. Now, it's possible that by seed he is referring to a whole dynasty, that he's using it collectively, like the sons of. But in the parallel passage in 1 Chronicles, it has the same account. It's very similar, but the wording is slightly different. In verse 11 of 17, it says, and it shall come about, when your days are fulfilled, that you must go to be with your fathers, that I will set up one of your descendants after you, who shall be of your sons, and I will establish his kingdom. So of the descendants, there will be a son. It says, it shall be one of your sons, and I will establish his kingdom. Not their kingdom, it's not plural, but it's singular. So, 1 Chronicles 17, the parallel passage, seems to make that the dynasty, that referring to a dynasty, be less likely. But rather it is an individual rather than a group of people. Okay, let's see what else we can cross off.
Only one more thing.
Yeah, I've crossed this one off. We were narrowing it down here. I've already indicated, it says that in verse 13, he says, "He shall build a house for my name, and I will establish the throne of his kingdom forever." How are we to take house here? Because in the first instance that it was used by David, it meant a building. And on a couple of, my goodness, on a couple of occasions.
What was that?
They are. The first time, house, when it was used by David, he meant a building, and he qualified it by house of cedar. Then God says, "You aren't going to build a house for me. I'm going to build a house for you." But there, the most natural way to take that from what goes on is not a building, but more likely a dynasty or something more like that. And it talks about the house of David. When it talks about the house of David, it's not talking about a building. It's talking about his household and his family. So here too it could be, "He shall build a house for my name." God saying, "I will build a house for you, and there will be a seed that will come along, and he will build a house for my name." Now are we talking about a building? Maybe, maybe not. It doesn't say a house of cedar. It just says house. Is it a building, or is it something else? He says he will establish an eternal kingdom, and he says, "I will be a father to him, and he will be a son to me. When he commits iniquity, I will correct him with the rod of men and the strokes of the sons of men. But my loving kindness shall not depart from him, as I took it away from Saul, whom I removed from before you." What he seems to be saying here is, the relationship that I will have with this seed is not going to be the relationship that I had with Saul. I anointed Saul as king, but when Saul was disobedient, I trashed him. I was done with him. But I am making a different kind of arrangement with you and your descendant. And that is, it will not be a relationship of limited duration. It's going to be a relationship like a father to son. Once a son, always a son. It can't be changed. Doesn't matter what you do. It's still a permanent relationship. It's a done deal. And it's going to be that kind of relationship that God is going to have with this offspring. Not like what he says, but my loving kindness, my loyalty, my commitment shall not depart from him, as I took it away from Saul, whom I removed from before you. So that's the contrast. That's what he's getting at. So that's what he means when he says the relationship will be like father and son. But it goes on to say, when he commits iniquity, I will correct him with the rod of men and the strokes of the sons of men. Now this is tough, because it would seem to rule out Jesus, because it says when he commits iniquity. And Jesus did not commit iniquity. So that would seem to rule him out, which would leave us with Solomon. And what would be said then is that Solomon was going to build a house, a temple, which Solomon did in fact do. But then we have the problem of, and your house and your kingdom will do forever before me, your throne shall be established forever. Okay. What's the problem? Oh, the funny people are back. Okay. But we do have the question 14. When does this happen with Solomon? When does it happen that he is corrected with the rod of men and the strokes of the sons of men? He did do iniquity. But when do we have him being corrected in this fashion? Now, it could be that it just means be corrected, and it's using figurative language. Now, the wording in verse 14 is tricky in the Hebrew. I know it's tricky because I had trouble with it. I won't get into it, but it's a bizarre construction in Hebrew. There are lots of ways to say to commit iniquity or to do wrong or to sin. Lots of easy ways to say that in Hebrew. This is none of those. This is an unusual expression that's used here. And the meaning of the word is not clear. This word does not appear very often. And I thought that it looked weird when I looked at it in the Hebrew, so I decided I'd look at the Septuagint in the Greek translation that was made 200 BC or whatever. And the Greek is weird too. So the Greek translators decided that the Hebrew was weird also. What it says in Greek is, if, literally, a very wooden translation, if comes unrighteousness, adikia, his. If comes his unrighteousness. And then it goes on, I will correct him. In Hebrew it says, here's where it gets tough. The word that is used is a verb that has been made from the Hebrew noun avon. And the Hebrew noun avon means wrongdoing, guilt, or blame, or punishment. It means all of those things. So what does the verb, and it's called a factitive verb. You take a noun and make it into a verb. It's called a factitive verb, stating that this noun stuff is true. How do you translate that? Well, it could mean when he does wrong. But it seems to me, it could also mean, and I say seems to me because none of the lexicons gave this as an option, but it seems to me it could also mean when he incurs guilt or blame, in his incurring guilt or blame. And that would make a difference. Well, it could be, or when he incurs punishment. Yes, Roger.
I don't know what kind of language, part of language this is, but you have this conditional, I guess.
Right.
If that,
right.
If this, that. So what's the wooden for the corrected?
What's the wooden for the
translation for the Hebrew for corrected?
No, that's for the...
I'm saying if it's possible that it could mean guilt.
Right.
What would be the corresponding thing for corrected? In other words,
how would this be translated?
Because it would seem natural to be translated as iniquity corrected.
Right.
But if it was guilt, then corrected may not be the proper term.
Corrected can also mean, let's see, did I write it down? I can't remember. It has another meaning that's not quite corrected. At the break, I'll get a lexicon and check it. Okay. Okay, so where do we go? Which one fits, or do we have a kind of dual, a mixed answer to the question? It is true that Samuel went on to build the temple. in 1 Kings 9:3, the temple is consecrated. Now, I read through this account of Solomon building the temple, and I see no indication that God came to Solomon and told him to build the temple. Solomon decides that it's the right time. Apparently, he remembers what God had told David, that his son would build a temple, and Solomon proceeds to do so. And then when it's all done, Solomon gives a long speech as to the nature of this temple, what will happen here, and its significance. And then when it's all done, God appears to Solomon in verse 3 of chapter 9 of 1 Kings. And the Lord said to him, I have heard your prayer and your supplication, which you have made before me. I have consecrated this house, which you have built, by putting my name there forever, and my eyes and my heart will be there perpetually. So God acknowledged this as his temple and sees it as a good thing. I think quite clearly he's seeing this as what Solomon has done is a good thing. But it seems to me that it still leaves open the question as to whether this is the house that he had promised that the seed of David would build. That it could be that what he's saying is that this is all in reference to Jesus. And that what he is saying is that he, the seed, will build a house for my name forever, and I will establish the throne of his kingdom forever. That house here has the significance of a whole kingdom. That will be the house of God. That will be the dwelling place of God. And now you can see why the verse earlier where I was talking about God's reason for not having David build the house, when he says, there were lots of leaders and I could have had them build the house for me and I didn't do it. What is the significance of that statement? Because if the implication there is, I don't want a house made out of cedar, then this interpretation makes more sense of it. In other words, what God would be saying is, out of David, I am going to bring a seed, a Messiah, a king who will rule forever, and he will build a house for me. He will build a kingdom that will be my dwelling place, a place that I will reside and be there and in it, a dwelling place that's really suitable. The dwelling place that's the kind of place that I want. Just one second. And I will establish the throne of his kingdom forever. I will be a father to him. He will be a son to me. And then I would have to, exactly how to translate this next part would have to be worked on. And that's something that I need to do. Curiously, in the parallel passage, this particular section, this sentence is not there. So it doesn't help us. Then, but my loving kindness shall not depart from him, as I took away from Saul, whom I removed from before you. And your house and your kingdom, speaking to David, shall endure before me forever. Your throne shall be established forever. Curiously, in the parallel passage, it says, my house and my kingdom shall endure forever. Do you want your question in this part, before or after the break? Okay, let's break now and then we'll do questions. Yes? Yeah. There's a place where this very verse is cited in the New Testament. In Hebrews chapter 1, I'll start with verse 3. And he is the radiance of his glory and the exact... Well, I'll go way back to the beginning. We'll just start right verse 1. God, after he spoke long ago to the fathers in the prophets in many portions and in many ways, in these last days has spoken to us in his Son, whom he appointed heir of all things, through whom also he made the world. And he is the radiance of his glory and the exact representation of his nature, and upholds all things by the word of his power. When he had made purification of sins, he sat down at the right hand of the majesty on high, having become as much better than the angels, as he has inherited a more excellent name than they. For to which of the sons did he ever say, to which of the angels did he ever say, Thou art my son, today I have begotten thee? And again, I will be a father to him, and he shall be a son to me, etc. So here this verse is cited. This afternoon, after I had written up my outline, done my thinking on this passage, I asked Jack who he thinks is being referred to in chapter 7 of 2 Samuel, and he had a different answer. So do you want to spell out your thinking and give option B?
Well, I think he's talking about Solomon. I'm persuaded by what you were saying about the household, though. That's very interesting, and you persuaded me that I just always assumed that the house he was going to build was the temple. But especially when you go on and read in the chapter, he didn't have time to do that, but when you go on and read in the chapter and read David's prayer back, it's clear that he thinks it's a household. Right. So that doesn't mean that the house that Solomon built couldn't be a temple, but it's really the only place in the passage that's talking about that then. And I'm persuaded by your point that basically God seems to be saying, "Why do I want a house of cedar? I don't want a house of cedar." So why would he bring up the fact that Solomon's going to build him a house? So that's persuasive to me. The reason I think it's Solomon, though, is he seems to be saying that something is going to start now, David. You're going to have a son that is going to be the beginning of your dynasty, or the continuation of your dynasty. And so when he says, "I will be a father to you and you will be a son to me, when you commit iniquity, I will chastise you with the rods of men," and so on and so on, "but I will not depart from you as I did from Saul." It seems to me that what he's saying is, you guys are going to screw up a lot, but when Saul did that, when Saul disobeyed me, I rejected him, I cut him off, and I was not committed to him. But I'm here to tell you, this is different now. I'm going to continue your seed, and my commitment to you and your child and his child after him and his child after him is irrevocable. I'm never going to go back on that. I may punish them. I may show them some hard times for their disobedience, but I will never reject them for their disobedience. Now, I don't know. And David talks about, in his prayer later, talks about looking into the distant future. That could go either way, but he seems to be recognizing that God is in this for the long haul. He's not so much looking at the future when God is going to do something, but God has chosen him now, today, and this is going to extend into the future. What's most tempting about taking it as Jesus is that quote, for example, in Hebrews, where he applies it to Jesus. But I would make the case that it's applied to Jesus because Jesus is the one of David's seed who is finally going to sit on that throne, not just for his lifetime, not just for his term, but for eternity. So he's sort of the son with a capital S. Solomon is a son with a small s, and Solomon's son after him is a son with a small s. And each and every generation there's a king of David who's qualified to sit on the throne, but only is the son with a small s, but the one is coming who's the son with the capital S, and that's Jesus. And he will establish David's throne forever and ever, and will personally rule eternally. The reason I say that is when you look at some of the Psalms, the title, the Son of God, appears to apply to every king after David who sits on the throne. It's a term that gets applied to them. I don't remember the number of the psalm, but one of the psalms Jesus quotes in John 10 and makes the case You want to stone me because I claim to be the Son of God? Well, look at your own scriptures. All of those guys were called the Son of God, and they were mere men. So what is your problem with me claiming that title? What they said to him is, we stone you because you, being a mere man, claim to be the Son of God. And he looks back at the psalm, where the psalmist says of all the leaders of Israel in the past, gives them the title the Son of God. So they were sons of God before Jesus, but Jesus is the Son of God with a capital S. So given that the Psalms treat it that way, I really don't see any difficulty with seeing Solomon as being the first in this dynasty that will eventually result in the eternal King Jesus sitting on the throne of that dynasty.
How do you take, I will correct him with the rod of men and the strokes of the sons of men?
Just as a reference to, it's in contrast to Saul, who is rejected. Saul's obedience resulted, disobedience resulted in rejection. Members of this dynasty may be punished, corrected. They may
figurative go, rather than actually with rods.
A figurative way of saying you may experience my wrath, but not my rejection.
Through the agency of man.
Yeah. I was just thinking about the when they approach God and say, I will build you a house, and it seemed like God was allowing them to build him a house, even though that really wasn't something that he strongly desired. He said, you know, have I ever asked you for a cedar house? And as it was man's idea, and it seemed like there's oftentimes in Scripture that God allows man's idea or invention to be completed, like we want a king.
Right.
Okay, you can have one. Go ahead, hang yourself. All your young men are going to be in the army now. And I just wondered if that isn't how he permitted the house in that world we were speaking of. Is
I had never thought of it that way before I studied this just this last week, but that's what occurred to me, is that it may be analogous to the appointment of a king, that Solomon forged ahead and did this, recalling what God had said to David and thinking that he was carrying out that promise. And God honored that act, and it did become a temple that was significant to God, and it was a place, a location that was very important, but it wasn't what God promised to David.
That was when you knocked down the temple, 3 days I rebuilt it. The one who said that was the temple, it would seem like it.
Any other questions, comments?
Study your distinction between the two kinds of seeds. What exactly was the Ishmael? Who were Ishmael's seed?
See, Ishmael was made into a great nation that became the Arabs. But it was not the line through which Abraham's name was passed.
But then you just talked about Eve's seed, and I didn't know that had even been a distinction at that point, having Abraham's one or a certain line.
Okay, let me go back. Seed can mean just offspring. And it's clearly used that way, especially with respect to animals and plants and stuff in the early parts of Genesis. It talks about and its seed. But as it's used in Genesis, it takes on a more specific connotation. It doesn't just mean offspring, but it means the child that inherits from me. That what I'm arguing is, if you look at it, when this word is used with respect to people, it's never used with respect to a child that does not inherit.
This might be confusing. Do you have in mind when you say that basically inherit the blessings of God?
It's
the inheritance, and the most important part of that inheritance when we're talking about a Genesis is whatever promises were given by God to that person. So it means offspring, but in Genesis it seems to be more, it takes on a different connotation, and that is not just offspring, but the one that will inherit. And as I think about how do we have the choice made as to who will inherit in Genesis, I can think of one exception. Jacob and Esau is an exception. But generally, the father selects the one that is his favorite. So I'm carrying it further. It's not just the inheritor, but there's something about that inheritor that's associated with this. The inheritor is the one that the father likes best, has the qualities that the father likes. So what I'm arguing is this technical sense that it's used in Genesis takes on these other connotations, and that is it's just the line of inheritance, and that the most important part of that inheritance is the promises made by God to that person. And also, the seed is the child with character, with the character of the father. And I'm just reasoning comes from this. Since inheritance was not decided on the basis of the order in which they were born, it's the father's choice. The father chooses someone that is the kind of character he would like.
Okay, so what I didn't understand then was when he's telling the weave, whatever that passage was that you read, you will.
3:16.
It's talking to the serpent. I confused you. 15.
Mm-hmm. Well, and between your seed and her seed, well, I thought seed there was all of mankind.
I don't think so. I think what's happening here is this is the first intimation that God is giving that mankind will be split in two. There will be a significant rift, division among mankind.
It's the division that the New Testament calls the children of God and the children of the devil.
Okay, so your seed, the serpent's seed, will be the children.
Right. Okay. Right. And that's where this becomes important. I think that this connotation has been wrapped up in it, and the seed of the serpent is people who reflect the character of the serpent.
You're suggesting that the character trait is actually the basis for the choice.
Right.
But it seems to me in Genesis that actually the basis of the choice is ultimately the will of God.
True. But
you, it's through the agency of the human father. And what I'm arguing is that inheritance was not done by tradition, but rather the father actually made a choice.
I see the correlation between the ultimate godliness of the chosen one and the fact that they are the heir. That's an important correlation, which is your main point.
Right.
But like in Jacob and Esau, Isaac tried his hardest to get the other one chosen, and it... Okay. God had other ideas.
Right.
And at the time that he chose him, I'm not sure Jacob was really this godly person that...
Right.
That might support your point, actually.
Well, all I'm arguing really is that
inheritance was not based on tradition. It was based on choice. And why would a father choose? On what basis does the father choose?
Right. And your assumption is this is a godly father.
This is a godly father. And so
what he's going to choose, you would think, would be a godly, the godly son. Denise?
Well, before Jack said that, I was going to say, I had the same question. Is it based on character, or maybe it was just based on the fact that he loved that child, mm-hmm. like in the case of Esau, mm-hmm. which I think is compelling for your point. I mean, you chose character. I don't know if you're real attached to that, but clearly, if your emphasis is choice for whatever reason, he loved him or whatever, but... And a point was just raised that I had never thought about, so I kind of would like to go back over it. And that is, I thought in Genesis, it was always the seed was symbolizing between Satan and Jesus. But you're both saying that this is talking about a division of generations of mankind.
A division between kinds of people. The most significant division in humanity is between those who are sons of God and those who are sons of the devil.
It's a completely new twist to that passage for me. I'm just kind of mind-boggled here. Because I thought it had always been taught, it was prophetic towards Jesus and his victory over Satan. Okay, can you kind of fill that out for me? Because I guess I don't see it at this point.
Genesis is not all real fresh in my memory, but what we have immediately following in chapter 4 is the story of Cain and Abel. And then we start following genealogies. We follow the genealogy of Cain. Then we follow the genealogy of Seth. And what's set up very early is this rift in mankind.
But isn't that particular verse in the context of, and I'm not contradicting you, truly question, in the context of God's cursing the serpent? Now, if God is cursing the serpent, what point, I guess I don't get the point where he's just basically saying now there are going to be two kinds of people. It seems to me the curse is more of a curse if he says, is it to the serpent? But where he says basically, you know, eventually you're going to be defeated through the seed of.
Right. What he's saying, the nature of the curse is, from now on, there's going to be this rift in humanity. And the sons of evil are going to do damage to the sons of God, the sons of righteousness, is the way I'll phrase it. But the sons of righteousness ultimately will deal a death blow to the sons of evil. And I think ultimately in Jesus.
The last part of 3:15, he shall bruise you on the head. You don't have any problem seeing that as Jesus.
No. I would see that kind of the way that you're seeing in 1 Samuel, that you're seeing that as referring to Solomon and the line of kings, but ultimately most true in Jesus. And I think that that's what we have here in Genesis 3.
So he shall bruise you on the head. That's ultimately going to be Jesus. And you shall bruise him on the heel. Is that the division between... I'm sorry, where are we getting the division between two kinds of people?
Division is before that. I will put enmity between you and the woman, and between your seed and her seed. So there'll be two hostile factions in mankind.
You're seeing that as mankind, not as Jesus and Satan.
Yes.
But then he goes on to address the serpent and Jesus.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But what...
Jack. David. Wouldn't the seed of unrighteousness be ultimately the children of the devil? And the seed of righteousness would be the children of the sons of God? Which ultimately, not, which is not Jesus per se, but it's following Jesus.
You're saying that, say it again?
I don't see where Denise is, and between your seed, which is unrighteousness, or the character of the serpent, and her seed, which is the character of the sons of God, but ultimately, when you pan them out, one's of Satan, one's of Jesus, one's of God. Is that?
Yeah, right. Okay.
So I don't see where Denise is off. Well, she was
assuming that the way she's been taking it is when it says between your seed and her seed, right, it's talking about Satan and Jesus rather than human beings.
Exclusively.
Oh.
But do they not operate through human beings? Jesus is reflected in humans, even through the lying, the seed. And Satan is reflected, like it says, 844, John 844, talks about the sons of Satan. Thank you.
I think it's helpful to realize that, Satan, unlike Eve, who had a lot of little critters, Satan's not procreating.
Oh.
Right? So, most literally, if you took it as the product of procreation, you'd have Satan's great, 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 something or other, fighting Eve's great, 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 something or other, and there's going to be enmity between
or snakes.
Or snakes. So the fact that it can't be the literal, procreated descendants of Satan suggests immediately that we're talking about a metaphor here. Somebody who's metaphorically an offspring of Satan and someone who's metaphorically an offspring of Eve. The literal offspring of Eve are not all of the seed of Eve, is the point that David's making. Cain was of the seed of Eve in that she was procreated by Eve, but she was not her offspring.
Mm-hmm. And one of the things that inclines me to see this referring to, especially to the sons of evil, the sons of wickedness and sons of righteousness, is this is the first mention with respect to people of the word seed. And as you trace it through Genesis, the seed is, it's this righteous line. That's what it's used to refer to. The only exception is that one reference to Ishmael, and there I think he's making clear what he means by seed in the specialized sense.
As I recall, the reason you're going with character is because of the mention in chapter 5, where I finally have someone after my own life,
kind of my own image and likeness, as opposed to Cain. In contrast to Cain.
Is that referring to Seth?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, the first one, Abel, would have been that one, except he was killed. Cain was cursed. And so the third man's now the first.
Seth was appointed in place of Abel.
Yes. Yeah. And the bruising of the heel, is that not when Christ was on the cross and died?
I think ultimately, yeah, that's what it's talking about.
But the bruising of the head, we will hear in the
was a mortal
head. A mortal blow
to Satan. And so the same thing carries on through the seed of man through Seth ultimately, and right up through Abraham and up to Christ. And that seems Christ was born through that line, not the other seed line.
But I think that when it says in between your seed and her seed, that that is indeed figurative there. That it's talking about spiritual affiliations rather than genealogy.